This is the Golf Life Faith podcast brought to you by College Golf Fellowship. I'm Toby Ragland, one of your hosts. Another host is Jace Barber, and we are CGF staff members full-time. We love serving the world of college golf, and this podcast is going to be conversations with our PGA Tour partners, with CGF and other partners in the world of golf, and we hope you learn a lot. We certainly will along the way. Hope you join us for the journey and learn all areas golf, life, and faith.
Welcome to the Golf Life Faith podcast. My name is Jace Barber. Toby Ragland, our other host, will also be on. And then Stephen Bunn, the Vice President of College Golf Fellowship, will be joining us. And our guest on the podcast today is Stuart Sink. We had an awesome conversation. We talked about a lot of Ryder Cup stuff, you know, with the Ryder Cup being this week. We talked about his current situation in professional golf on the PGA Tour Champions and all that he's doing there. And then the most important and you know, fruitful conversation we had was about his walk with the Lord and a little bit of his testimony. You're really going to enjoy this one. Stuart's the best. So we look forward to sharing this with you.
Stuart, welcome to the Golf Life Faith podcast. It's awesome to have you on today, especially this week. We are recording Wednesday of Ryder Cup week. And just I'd love to get to know your experience with team events. And I think we can just start off by you sharing what it was like to hit that first tee shot in your first Ryder Cup.
Well, it's been a little while, but that was in 2002, actually. It was supposed to be in 2001, but that was the Ryder Cup that got delayed by 9/11. And so the whole shot, the shot on the first tee, it really needs some backstory. So I had a couple of good years, 2000, 2001. I was an automatic qualifier, but towards the end of 2001, I was starting to slip a little and my game was just not where it was before. And I ended up being the last qualifier. And back then it was 10 and there was two picks. So I was the 10th guy. And now that I've been around golf a lot longer, I feel like the last qualifier is like the worst spot on the team because you're kind of like the tail end of the guys who made it. And you're right before the guys that the captain says, I want you. So you're like the worst spot. And I just felt like maybe I was putting more on it than it needed to be, but I was like, I'm the last qualifier. My game's not been good. And, you know, I was just, woe is me. And then boom, 9/11 happens. We get another year and you think like, oh, I got a chance to like rebound and get back up into, well, no, I didn't do that. I just continued to slide downward and worse, just worse and worse. So, by the time we head over to the Ryder Cup, I'm just like feeling like instead of turning this first Ryder Cup into like a awesome experience and, you know, this is like a new rung on the ladder of my career, I'm like, can we please get this over with? And so so that kind of puts you into like the frame of mind I was in at the Ryder Cup. And I mean, I was not playing bad or anything, but like relative to somebody who's like qualified as an automatic on the Ryder Cup team, I was probably not quite up to that standard. So I was partnered up with Jim Furyk in the first match, and it was the second session. So I sat out, further delaying my first Ryder Cup experience the first morning, sitting out and just like, oh my gosh, can we please get started? And Furyk and I were playing alternate shot, and he's a veteran, you know, and I looked up to him, even though he's not that much older than me, but he had been on teams already. And we did our practice, you know, and figured out, you know, who's going to hit on the odds and evens. And it just worked out where my shots worked best on the odd holes and his worked best on the even holes. And we're on the putting green about 6 minutes before we walk to the first tee. And I hear the crowd noise from the groups before me, you know, and I've heard it all morning. And I'm just kind of like, everything's just coming to a head. And I walk over to Jim and I said, I know we practice and everything, but you got to hit that first shot. And without even, I mean, we didn't even discuss it. He's like, okay. And we just flipped, you know, back in those days, there was no statistical, you know, there was no data team or anything like there is now. And so we had no real hard data that said that I should be on one side and he should be on the other. It was all by feel and just kind of looking at the course. But he said I would take the first shot, and he went ahead and hit it, and I was relieved. He hit it. I mean, it couldn't have been the more perfect result for somebody that was hitting their first shot in the Ryder Cup after all this. He hit it down the right side of the fairway and it settled in the first cut. And it was up on top of the grass, like this high above the soil. I mean, it was like, it was better than hitting off any mat at any public driving range you ever hit off. It was perfect. 8 iron, couldn't have been more perfect. So I get up over the ball or kind of get into my routine after, you know, figuring out the yardage. I had like 165 or whatever. And it was a full 8 iron. And I remember getting behind the ball and kind of like putting my club like I always did. And then being like, what do I normally do in my pre-shot routine? Like I literally for 5 seconds standing there, I couldn't remember what I do. Do I take a practice swing? Do I go ahead and just walk to the ball? Do I go up grass? I was lost. And it was just the moment. So I just finally decided like, okay, well, maybe it's time to start a new routine right now. Let's just start from scratch. So I just walked into the ball and aimed and hit it. And I hit a good shot. I was a little pumped. So I hit it about 25 feet past, but on the green. And I was like, okay, that's over. Finally, you know, I can like relax a little bit. Well, I was wrong because Furyk decided that he wanted to be real aggressive on the first green and kind of like go for the birdie and get us one up. And well, he made a good roll at it, but it rolled about 4 feet past. So I'm here I am, you know, digging in my pockets for the coin. And I'm like, oh, great. Now, you know, I just finally got over the hump. And now my second shot, I have to try to jiggle one in from 4 feet to have the hole, which I did jiggle it in. And that was kind of the end of the heartbeat. And it kind of settled in from there. But that was kind of the whole saga of my first shot in the Ryder Cup. You know, I've heard guys say, like, I couldn't put the tee in the ground. I couldn't, like, hear myself think. I couldn't breathe and all that stuff. Well, all those things are true. And I couldn't have had a more perfect setup, ball teed up on it with an 8 iron. And it was quite a moment. But we actually went on to win that match. So wow. Furyk was awesome. He was an incredible leader to me. And just he was understanding. He there was no like, you're a tough kid. Come on, you can do it. It was just like, here's what we're going to do. And I trusted him. And he led me right through. And we got a win. We played awesome. And we didn't win the Ryder Cup, but we got that first match for Team USA.
Hey, who did you guys play that match?
I can't even remember. Oh, I love it. I can't even remember. That was in 2002, so it's been a little while. I couldn't even guess who we played. I couldn't even guess.
I love the amount of data that goes into who hits what tee shots now to how y'all determined who went evens odd. That is amazing.
Oh, on social media,
change pre-shot routine in the approach shot.
Yeah, by definition, a routine is something you do every time. So if you start a new one, it's technically not a routine yet, is it? But it, I guess, became one after that because I was like, well, I forgot what I used to do, so I'll just start something new.
That's so good. I saw a graph from this Ryder Cup showing every single golf ball that every guy plays on both teams and showing the matchups that go best for each guy that plays the different golf balls. That's how deep we're getting into this.
Yeah, that stuff matters a lot for you know, it depends on the player because there's some players who are just really touchy about the ball they hit off the tee and with their irons and stuff. And they just don't feel like they can be successful with a ball that's not the one that's perfectly fit for them. And there's other players that are just like, I don't care. You know, give me a sleeve of your balls. I'll hit 3 or 4 shots today in the practice round. And if I don't see anything weird, then we'll use yours. And it just depends on the player. Every team, I'm sure both teams have players that fit into both categories this year at the Ryder Cup, and they're probably figuring out how to deal with that. And you know, you can pair around that. Usually you can put a guy who doesn't care with a guy who really cares, as long as you know you think they're kind of similar. But the golf ball has sort of like, you know, it's the technology behind the ball has diverged somewhat in the pros, where now, you know, you've got such specificity with each player that you can tailor your game to the ball and vice versa.
I think one of the big advantages of the analytics is just how it's more in the course setup and how there does seem to be both Europe and USA, we have the narratives that are set of kind of the stereotypes of both teams. Like, you know, when it's over there, they're going to try to take wedge out of play for US as much as they can. try to have some longer par fours. You know, there's just these narratives that exist. It's, that seems like a pretty big deal where the analytics fit in. But I love what you, that story you told about Jim Furyk, because I think there's a lot of guys that listen to the podcast that play college golf, and just how you handle nerves. And I love how, first of all, that's so Jim's personality. He's so even keeled. And just to say, you know, it's that's who he is, but he also had a lot of experience that he was drawing from. But how, I love how you talked about your nerves and how after that first hole, though, you were just back to playing golf and how you were able to kind of function. Of course, you wiggling in that 4-footer is why you were on a Ryder Cup team. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. And the funny thing is, like, I did feel like I wiggled it in. Like, it was like a hope, you know, like, oh, please don't miss. And it goes in. But when I remember watching the coverage and when they showed that putt, let's cut to one and Stuart Sink trying to have the hole here. And I mean, it looked like the purest thing you ever saw, and it couldn't have gutted the hole more. You know, it was just like, but that's in the pros, that's kind of one of the tricks you have to learn, is like, you may feel like on the inside, you're just crumbling and you're like, you know, incapable of succeeding. But on the outside, the reality is your body, if you just let it do what it does, you know, can be pretty decent even when you don't feel right.
So it sounds like preparation and being committed to that is really good stuff.
Yeah, that's true. As long as you believe in it. But there's been plenty of times too when I prepare and prepare and prepare, and then you get to the first hole and you're like, all right, I'm going to do something a little different now. There's a great story from Gary Hallberg is kind of low key legend in the pros. He's about a 60. He's probably 10 years older than me, maybe 15. But he was playing a tournament a long time ago, and on the practice green, he and his caddy were trying something new, and he was just like filling it up. I mean, making everything from everywhere. And they get up to the first hole in the tournament, and Hallberg's up to putt, and he replaces his ball, and he calls his caddy over, and caddy thinks he's going to ask him, like, you know, do you think this is like, you see this left edge or whatever, you know? And caddy comes in there and kind of looks down the line like this, and Hallberg goes, hey, you remember that on the putting green, what we were doing? And the caddy goes, yeah. And he goes, what was it?
So good.
He forgot. So we're all like that in this, in a way. I mean, I've been practicing, you know, many, many times, and I feel like, oh, I've just got golf completely figured out. And then the next day I'm like, I either can't remember what I did or what I did was like completely not working. So you have to go and figure it out again.
Yeah. I think a lot of people take comfort in hearing that.
Yeah. Hey, that describes my golf game. But Stuart, yeah, with that, any other fun stories? Because you were on the 2008 team, the Valhalla, like Paul Azinger. That's kind of like, wasn't that like the first kind of data centric one? Like where they started like pretty heavily, like getting into these certain pairings and pods and stuff.
Actually, I would say that it still wasn't data heavy. The only thing that changed then was Paul Azinger was our captain, and he brought in a personality, like he was a sports psychologist, but he's kind of a personality expert in a way. So he helped Zinger sort of put us all into sort of groups that would be compatible, at least on paper. So that's where the pod thing came from, you know, and it was guys that had similar personality styles would theoretically pair up together and, you know, spend practice round time together, dinners and stuff like that. You just were with, it was like three teams within a team. And that was the first time that really occurred. And the only time it occurred. As far as when the data came in from the on-course stuff, like we had ShotLink data going back to 2003, but at 2008, we had no idea what to do with it. No idea. And then, 2010, we played over there, so we didn't have any ShotLink data. But from 2010, which was my last play in Ryder Cup, until 2023, which was my next appearance in the Ryder Cup in any way in Italy last time, somewhere along there in that gap is where the data became like a heavy part of the pairings and the selections of the captain's picks and all that. I don't know when, because I was completely out of the Ryder Cup process for all that time. And when I got back into it in 2023, all of a sudden we had these teams of data experts that were parsing every category and and all that. So I don't know when exactly it occurred, but it wasn't 08. It was after that, and it was before 2023.
So you had a pretty big gap between, you know, 2010 playing in the Ryder Cup, 2023 being part of that that team over there. What was it like to be on the non-playing side at the Ryder Cup?
It was really interesting, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Zach Johnson was the captain. He's one of my best friends, and I love serving for him and serving the, you know, Team USA as a whole, the players. You know, I kind of felt like I was part caddy in a way. I didn't have to carry too many bags, but I was doing a lot of the prep work that I thought I would be helpful to them, you know, doing. Basically, it's kind of like you just want to ask how you can serve and let them tell you. Some of the caddies wanted specific things in the practice days just to kind of take a little bit of their, you know, some of the stuff they would normally do, like putting out where the hole locations were going to be, or maybe finding out where the tee boxes were placed, just stuff like that, golf course stuff. And once practice round started, we were able to be helpful doing that and taking some of the load off them. And then during the rounds, you know, like Bun was my cart driver, and he and I, your job is pretty much be a spectator. Once the matches start, you know, your pairings are done, you're rooting for them, like, go team. And then if they need something, which they didn't need that much, I mean, they're still playing golf and they're kind of used to how many bars to pack. And I was still surprised at how many times they ran out of stuff and they came to the cart asking for things, because I mean, maybe I'm one of the few, but I always pack the same number of bars and the same banana and the same little, all my stuff is in the bag the same for a round. And those guys seem to run out an awful lot. Back me up on that, Bun. They came to the cart.
Well, remember, routine changes when you're nervous.
I guess so. That's true. So I guess maybe they.
Oh my gosh! Forgot. How many bananas do I pack? Yeah. I don't remember.
Hey, can you run to the to the clubhouse and grab us another sleeve of balls? But you know, you try to be.
Which, by the way, Stuart, we could always stop at the clubhouse and get more balls or whatever they needed, because you and I would stop every day at the turn to get a macchiato. That was the best part of being in Italy.
It was so great, and we learned that you do not order a cappuccino after 11 a.m. It's a breakfast coffee.
Yeah,
you have to switch over to the macchiato.
There you go.
Yes. Otherwise, they look at you and they say, "You're a tourist."
Thinking Americans.
So good. They had the barista was awesome. He was probably the highlight. But now, once the matches start, you just kind of like, you're literally a support member. And before the matches start, before your trip over there, you know, me and the four other guys who were assistants were just trying to help make decisions and provide input. And again, Jim Furyk was on that team as an assistant, and I thought he even provided great leadership to me as an other assistant, because I noticed that he was kind of not really saying much during the talk about who we should pair with who. And everybody kind of had an opinion, but Furyk was quiet, and I asked him about it, and he just said, "I just felt like when I was captain, I felt like that too many voices in the room was like more of a kind of a distraction than kind of what I wanted to go with." And he just was quiet, didn't really say much. And I guess that was his way of endorsing what the captain was thinking. But I think it takes a lot of maturity and discipline to sit there and hear all the discussion going on and not really chime in. But he was few words. And I think that kind of, in a way, few words said a lot.
Tell us more about that experience of having a cart driver, or Bud. Maybe you can answer that. Give us a window into that.
Well, I was going to tell one funny story from the first day. Got off to a horrendous start, and just things were not going well on Friday morning at all in any match. We all had the earpieces in. The intensity was palatable. It really was, and there just wasn't a lot of mojo. Well, somewhere on the golf course, assistant Ryder Cup captain, former winning Ryder Cup captain Davis Love is sitting on his mic button. Do you remember this, Stuart?
Yeah.
And it's at the most intense part. Like, nobody's talking, nobody knows what to say or whatever. And Davis is accidentally sitting on his mic, and you hear him talking about man, have you ever seen the trout up in that river and outside of Asheville? You know, he's talking to somebody about fishing. And it's the most, and it's during the most intense time. And you hear another captain, another assistant come on and go, Davis, you're pressing your mic button.
Yeah, the sequence of the conversation was something like this. Burns and Chef were four down. Morikawa, four down. Yeah, they have some pretty awesome trout in that stream up north of Asheville. We went up there. Davis.
That is so well described.
And we were all just sitting in our carts, like, you know, like this, and watching, and all of a sudden everybody's like, Davis. It's easy to do, though. I mean, there's a lot of buttons on those things.
Oh, my
God. I can remember Stuart and I had, well, I don't know how good a time he had. I had a great time riding him around, and we, we had all the emotions. You could feel the adrenaline. You could feel Saturday afternoon was an unbelievable highlight, coming down to Pat Cantley making a big putt at the end of his match. And it was just and we had a sickness that was running through the team that a lot of people didn't know about. I remember Max was throwing up almost all around the golf course. Greg Bledsoe, the team doctor, had to walk around with him and keep towels on him. And he and Brian Harmon won a match that they played awesome that day. But there was just the little things like being able to pull up behind, even though, and in fact, I remember telling Stuart this. I was like, I know I'm not supposed to be for him, and I'm not for him, but my goodness, I'm loving sitting 20 yards behind in the middle of the fairway behind John Rahm, just watching him swing with no abandon. I mean, just absolutely no abandon. But the funniest my funniest memory I remember with you, Stuart, is we were both just kind of leaned back, kind of watching, and Ludwig Oberg came through, and you know, and his name, that A has the two dots on it. And we were sitting there, his standard was right in front of us. And I just asked Stuart, how many Scrabble pieces do you think they have in their language? If you have to distinguish an A with two dots on it, you know, it's like, that's a lot of letters.
Yeah, they have their own version of Scrabble for sure.
Also, Bun, good work right there pronouncing Ludwig. Ober. That was phenomenal. Yeah.
Thank you.
That was good work.
Nice job.
Well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
I didn't realize, it's one of the things I learned at the Ryder Cup when, as an assistant not playing, was how crucial the cart thing is, because, you know, you get over there in the practice rounds and the course is pretty much wide open early in the week. And it's just like, if you and I took a golf cart out right now, you can just go anywhere. But when you imagine a golf course that has, I don't know how many thousands of people. Is it like 35,000 people a day or something?
No, I think it was like 60 over there.
60,000? Yeah, it was a golf course that could handle a lot of people. 60,000 people around four groups. All of a sudden, you can't take the cart anywhere. And so the planning, the operations team for the course setup did a great job of leaving places where the carts could enter and exit near the greens and tees and make it, you know, so you're not going to run over people, and you can actually get the carts through, because each match has, I mean, how many carts were in each match? It was a minimum of four carts per match that were kind of just hovering around the greens. You can see it when you watch the Ryder Cup out in the fairway. When you're watching putting out in the fairways, you'll see the carts like just kind of sitting, like waiting to go to the next tee. And Randy Meyer was key, because he's done that so many times that kind of giving us advice on what to do with the carts and where to go and what to anticipate. And the drivers had to adapt all that stuff. I mean, I was doing a lot of walking too, because it was a little easier and you could talk to the players easier and run their extra sleeves of golf balls out to them on foot. But the cart issue is a real thing. And making sure that you can go where you need to go, and you can service, you know, multiple groups and all that stuff, especially singles. You know, when you singles, the crowds are spread out a little bit more, but it's also, you got to cover more groups, because there's only so many assistants, and Zach, the captain this year, you know, Keegan's not going to be going back and forth between groups as much as the assistants do. But the cart thing, the logistic part of it was pretty complex.
But y'all had a great time together in Italy. Tell us, but y'all get to spend more time together now in your current stage of golf. So what's life like on the Champions Tour? I guess we can give that question to Stuart first. So What is Champions Tour like right now?
We actually, me and Bun, you know, for the listeners and the watchers out there who may not know this, but Bun has been the main guy doing the PGA Tour Fellowship Bible study, whatever you want to call it, out there for the last, what, about 7-8 years now?
That'd be 15, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. 15 years. And so, you know, that's his main role. But I think there's going to be a transition fairly soon where Stephen and Lisa Bunn are going to come out to the Champions Tour and sort of take over the role out there. So that'll be great. But we've been on this little bit of a lull where I haven't seen him that much since I turned 50, and now I'm 52. So been playing more on the PGA Tour Champions Senior Circuit, and I've enjoyed it. I love playing out there. Know everybody, and it's a lot of new venues. So that's been kind of nice to see some new courses and just go to different towns. And I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and I love playing. So just to sort of flip the page and enter a new sort of chapter, I guess. And I feel super blessed because golf has this sunset for your career that no other sport has anything like this. So it's really been fun. And, you know, I've been playing okay. Won a couple times already. So I feel like I might should have won a little more, to be honest. But it's either way, you know, you put yourself in contention. It's a blast coming down the stretch trying to finish victories off.
Would y'all say, you know, Stuart, Bun, would y'all say it's like the same level of
intensity,
you know, focus and intensity out there?
No. I mean, it's the PGA Tour is the pinnacle of the game. And when you get on PGA Tour Champions, it's kind of like going back in time because the players out there are mostly doing things the way they did, you know, back in time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't have any shot link. There's very little data. So you just can't use your on-course data to make decisions like you can on the PGA Tour because there's nothing that exists. And then it's just a little bit more camaraderie infused with when you get on the last nine holes on Sunday, and if you're close to the lead, then it gets up to where it feels similar to, you know,
yeah.
I mean, trying to win a tournament feels like the same no matter where you are.
I'll tell you one thing, Stuart, on that is it's pretty amazing is you would expect like the rookies on tour, on the Champions Tour to come in and dominate. But the fact of the matter is you still got guys 65, 66, 67 years old that just know how to dadgum get the ball in the hole, man. And they know how to win tournament. And you might be hitting it 40 past them and they just know how to get it around.
Well, there's a little bit of a rookie factor out there too, because, even though you have probably a skill set that's a little bit superior to a guy that's 10 years older than you, just in sheer, you know, dynamics and power, that person has 10 reps on a golf course that you've never seen before. And every little putt or every little, you know, where to leave it on a par five, little things like that, that they have written down their yards book in that little handwriting, that just adds up over the course of a tournament. And it's hard to overcome that. And when a guy's on top of his game, like Miguel Jimenez this year has been playing really well. He's seen these courses a whole lot of times. And I mean, every facet of his game has been very, very reliable, and he knows how to win. He's won a whole lot, and he's won four times just this year. So there's a rookie factor too. It's unlike other sports where, or the PGA Tour even, when you come in as a rookie, your skill set lacks and your decision-making and your experience lacks. PGA Tour Champions, your skill set is way up here, but your experience on the courses is behind.
Bun, for you, you know, kind of slowly starting to get out there. What's kind of the difference been like for you going out on Champions and PGA Tour?
Well, I've only done a couple events so far, but in fact, we were joking that I was making my debut in St. Louis. Stuart and I stayed together and hung out a bunch. But I'll say this for me, there's not a lot of difference in terms of just where my passion and my heart goes. I mean, the greatest joy I have in life is to sit down with people and talk to them about life. And my desire, my hope is to love people, whether they are believers, not believers, just to kind of earn the right to have a relationship in their life. And so that doesn't matter what age, you know, age bracket you're in or what level tour, or for that matter, I have a hard time distinguishing between my cul-de-sac and the PGA Tour or the Champions Tour. I just don't care. I mean, I just, you know, I'm passionate about doing that and doing life with people, whether they live next door to me or whether I get on a plane and go to a tournament. But one fun difference that I've noticed, one of the most frequent questions that I get from guys back home over the years of PGA Tour is like, or somebody that doesn't know me, they're kind of getting asking questions about going out and serving them. They go, do you take your golf clubs with you and play golf at tournaments? And on the PGA Tour, I'm like, no. Like, no, I don't. I mean, maybe at Greenbrier once a year, Stewart, or something like that, I'd go play at an offsite place, but never did I get to play golf. My first event I'm getting ready to go to on the Champions Tour that's not in Birmingham where I live, I usually go to that event, but this one up in St. Louis, Stewart called and said, hey, if I'm not in the Wednesday or Thursday Pro-Am, I've got to set up to go play golf. And I was like, really? I was so excited to get to take my clubs to a tournament. And then, even better than that, more than golf, I love to eat. And Stewart and Davis Love have been my food buddies for years. And so I've missed that big time. So I show up on Thursday. I've had lunch with Tommy Gainey, who's a rookie. And Stewart comes running up to me. This is the truth. He goes, hey, are y'all done yet? Like, you know, Tommy's just pouring his life out, and I'm pouring my life out to him. So he's like, hey, are you done yet? There's this fire station that has a brick oven.
Yeah, pizza oven.
Out on like the 16th green. And I'm not in the Pro-Am yet, but we need to drive out there and go try this. It's awesome. So I get on a cart with him. We make a special trip out to the brick oven or pizza oven. We get out there. Ernie L stopped by. He's sitting there eating pizza with us. Love it. We get back. I go back to the range. And all of a sudden, I see Justin Leonard, and we're connecting. And then Justin goes, hey, have you had the sliders out on the 8th green? They're unbelievable. I was like, no. And so he's like, come on. He just quits his practice, gets on a cart, drives out. He's like, oh, no, I'm not playing the Pro-Am. We're not playing through. We just came out to eat. You know? And I was like, man, I love the Champions Tour.
Well, you can explain that in a couple of ways. Number one, though, the main thing is everybody has a cart in the Pro-Ams. And so if there's food on site that word gets back to everybody that's pretty good, it doesn't matter if you're playing or not. You got a cart. You take it out there, and you act like you're playing. And you grab a slice of pizza or you grab a slider. I wish it was like that at every tournament, but sadly, not quite.
Yeah, that was just a nice for me. It set expectations, though.
Yeah, it is, you know, everything's a little bit more laid back. There's less people around. There's just... You know, I mean, it's minor league golf when it comes to like the big picture of pro golf. And, but the players are excited to have it and play, and they play hard. And, there's, you know, guys may not all look like, if you look at the PGA Tour, guys look similar, you know, they all swing with optimal, positioning, and the ball launches the same, and they're all fast and they all hit it far and all that. On the Champions Tour, there's a lot of different looking swings and different looking bodies. But in the end, they all have arrived at the Champions Tour because they've done a great job in pro golf for a long time. And there's very few guys that are newcomers. It's guys that have just gotten the job done. I mean, just flat out succeeded for a long time. And they don't lose that. It's fun to see. It's different. Not always easy to play against, but, like I said before, it's a really awesome blessing to be able to do this at 52. And, you know, hopefully I got a long runway ahead of me, and I'm enjoying it.
Man, I totally get that. And I can tell that you do. But you have a lot of joy in your life anyway. That's very apparent. And which, not to cut you two guys off, but I do want to ask you about that in a second, Stewart. But I do want to mention real quick, like you were talking about the, like even my wife and I potentially, you know, starting the process of coming out there more. Larry Moody, who was out on the PGA Tour for years before Brad Payne and myself came out to the PGA Tour and now on the Champions Tour, has really paved the road so well for us. He's the one that has extended invitation to come out, and I look forward to doing that alongside him as we make this transition. But it's so nice to be able to go down a road that has already got pavement on it because he's so trusted by so many players and been such a face for a long time. It's really cool to just to get to do kind of generational ministry with people and to pass baton. And just like I still look at Toby and Jace as the little young fellas on staff with College Golf Fellowship and to see what a great job they do. But Stuart, you talked about just kind of enjoying being out there, and you've had a lot of adversity in your life, a couple of big pitfalls when you were younger. And then one, it's been, I don't know how many years ago, it's now been 8 or 9 years ago, another one. And yet I still see the same person that has a real peace about them and has a joy. And I've watched you change a lot over the time that I've known you. And so I'd love for you just to take a minute and tell Jason, Toby's listeners, just kind of about what's kind of behind that. What where have you seen that change? Why are you changed? Why is it that even though you've been through some real adverse moments, why is it that you have so much peace and joy in life?
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that. I wish I always felt peaceful. You know, I mean, I don't.
Hey, you remember?
A human being
hey, you remember
alive.
How you felt on the putt and how yeah. it was seen on the video? That's a great analogy of this.
Yeah,
that's what I see versus how you feel, and even how you can in your answer. How do you justify or reconcile those two differences?
Well, I think the easiest way to explain it, and there's probably a harder way to explain it, but the easiest way is to say that ever since I found Christ, and I was a slow learner. It took me till my mid-20s, and I'd been married already for like 6 years to finally say like, oh my gosh, now I understand the pastor's talking about this crucifixion, which I always knew about. I always knew that Jesus died on the cross. I didn't understand why until I was in my mid-20s. And all of a sudden, I'm like, ah, oh, this is like, I'm like in the Bible says, he slew me. You know, I just was like, I was crushed thinking about all the time I had missed, but also excited knowing that now I kind of see this more clear that it wasn't just God gave his son to die on the cross and okay, it's over. It was like, what did that mean? Well, that he took the sin that we can't deal with as a civilization of human beings, we failed at sin, and God sent his son to take our place and pay the penalty for sin so that we can be back in fellowship with him. That was at that point I realized, okay, this is like the biggest change in my life. And I'd already gone through some stuff. And, you know, my wife and I found out we were having our first one when we were in college at 19. He was born when we were 20. We got married before that. So we were really young when we got started. And I had a lot of people saying, like, you know, pretty much like you ruin your life and all that. And people close to me. And I didn't, it's not like I set out to prove anybody wrong. I was just like trying to put one foot in front of the other, you know, and keep my head above water. And then you know, golf was there for me. You know, I was a pretty decent player all along, and I never was the kind of guy that looked at golf as like a ticket or a destination, like I'm going to the PGA Tour or else. I just felt like I like golf and I want to try to get good at it and I want to be better tomorrow than I am today. And that just kind of turned into, you know, by the time I was going to college or even in college, I was looking around going like, okay, well, now I'm like beating everybody. And so I think circling back to, like I said before, this is a real easy way to describe it. And now I've gone on for like 9 minutes. As I got older, though, I think now it's been 25 years or so since I accepted Christ. And I think my priorities with it have switched a little bit. And that now I used to think of it as just something for me, like it was like a relationship between me and Christ. And now I think of it as like almost a three-way relationship between Christ and me and everybody else around me. And going back to what Larry Moody, you mentioned him earlier, he's been a mentor of all of ours for so long. And I don't know who he quotes when he says this, you guys probably know, but when he says, always be preaching the gospel and when necessary, use words. That was one of Larry's favorite quotes. And I always thought, like, well, I don't really feel like I'm a great speaker, but I can just live my life so that people might see me. And the ones who experience being around me might say, like, what is it about that guy? Like, he always seems peaceful, like Bun mentioned. And I think that's the point, is that as I've gotten a little bit older, I've tried to use my life as a way to demonstrate Christ inhabiting inside my heart. And basically, he's operating through me. Like, the me that I used to know doesn't exist anymore, and it is Christ. And when people see that, I hope that they would point to him. And so I think that's what Bun's noticed in the change in me, is that over the years, I've just felt like I'm way more, I'm trying to be outward with just as being kind of an example. You know, I'm not saying I'm better than the next guy, because I'm a believer in Christ and I've accepted Christ and that's my life. But I'm just saying, like, hey, this has made a major change for me. I believe that the Bible is inaccurate, or is inerrant, and it's accurate. And it says that if Christ was who he says he is, I believe that. And I just want everybody else to experience what I've experienced.
That's so good, because I know that, you know, in our life, when we sit and look at we look out the window, we look in a mirror, we see the brokenness of the world. We look outside the window, we see the brokenness of the world. I see it in me. I see it out there. And Jesus's message, which is the entire Bible put together in summary, is just God's incredible love for us, in order to say, look, I know you don't feel like you're enough. I know you don't feel like you measure up. I know, whether it be, if it could be a girl thinking I'm not pretty enough, a guy thinking I'm not strong enough, I'm not big enough, I'm not enough, period. Whatever it is. Or why do I do the things I don't want to do? Why is it that I want to do these things and I don't do them? Why am I so messed up? That question, what is wrong with me, right, that we ask. Mm-hmm. And just that God, his incredible love for us, that even in spite of a broken world, that he sits right before us and gives us that provision and the invitation from Jesus to come to him to say, hey, look, if you want to know forgiveness like you've never known forgiveness, I will forgive everything you've ever done and will never remember it again. If you want to know love that you've never known, I will love you unconditionally, no matter what. If you want to know peace like you've never known, I will give you assurance for all of eternity, regardless of what's going on in this broken, blown up world around us. And I think for those that have come to accept his invitation to come to him, and for him to be, like, as you mentioned, your personal savior of your brokenness, of your sin, the fact that we have, you know, I mean, just our lives in general, just offensive to a holy, perfect God, because he's sinless and we're sinful, right? Mm-hmm. But you look, and for those that have accepted that, I know I still have so many things I'm broken, and areas that are broken in my life, messed up. But I have such hope and confidence in him, not in me, that I think, Stuart, what I see in you is, and I'm thinking back, you know, a few years ago when I was at the Zurich Classic and you were supposed to be there. And all of a sudden I got one of the most tear-filled conversations I've ever had with a friend when you called to tell me about your wife's diagnosis. And if y'all don't know Lisa Sink, if you think Stuart's great, she's up here anyway. And to get that call and just to see where part of the brokenness of the world is that bad things happen, and to watch them put their focus, their hope, their eyes, not perfectly, but to put it on their Savior, and to see that joy could come out on the other side is inexplicable. I was so, this past Sunday, I saw the quote from Charlie Kirk's wife, Erica, and she had the audacity, and I say audacity with quotation marks, to say, I forgive the man that shot my husband. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make sense unless you understand and know exactly what Stuart was talking about. It can make you say things like that just don't make human sense. And so, Stuart, I think that's, you know, you communicated it well. That's what I see in you. I know you don't think that, you know, you're just kind of wiggling life into the hole, so to speak. And yet what's being produced is that God is doing a work in your life, and there's fruit being produced, and it's so encouraging. You encourage others, and not just with your actions. Stuart's also very articulate, does a great job with his words. Yeah. I've heard him at many, many, many events share with men how they can also have a personal relationship with Jesus. And man, I love you, and I'm grateful to have you as a friend and a brother in Christ.
Appreciate it. I feel the same way. And I think, Bun, you and I kind of share a specific view of our gospel saved souls. And that is that view of brokenness that, I don't know that I think there's a lot of different ways to sort of view it, but you and I definitely share that. And, it's just, you know, I guess I want to thank you for opening my eyes to how crappy I am.
So good.
Hey, that's what I'm here for, baby. Just to tear you down.
There you go. I need more. But no. Actually want to mention this too. My wife right now, Lisa, is doing a Bible study at our local club here with another lady to the women's Bible study over there. And they took on this light reading C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity, you know, just this little bit of like, she probably has the audiobook, but I was letting her read it out loud to me a few times. Cause you know, when you read stuff like that, if you're like me, I got to read every sentence like 5 times before I comprehend exactly what it's saying. It's a trudge, you know, you got to get through it, but it's so amazing. And one of the things that he said that stuck out to me is that, ever since creation and God elevated us, meaning human beings, above the animals and the plants and everything, and kind of gave us a self. Once there was a self, that there's always been the tendency to be putting yourself first. And it created creation in a way, kind of created this almost auto division between us and God's perfection, that we were going to always look to ourselves first. Mm-hmm. And it happened at the very first sin back in the Garden of Eden. And it's still happening every minute of my life right here inside me, putting myself first. And it's the sneakiest sin that you can be a part of. And most of the world just goes about their life without even noticing. But that's what I mean by Steve and Bun helping me understand how broken I am, because noticing that helps you understand how lost you are and how bad you need Jesus Christ. And for that, I can't thank him enough. And I can't thank
Amen.
God enough for sending me that lifeline.
Hey, Stuart. This is a great way to wrap up here. C.S. Lewis from Mere Christianity, the book you're just referencing, said this: the great thing to remember is that though our feelings come and go, his love for us does not. His love is not wearied by our sins or our indifference. And therefore, his love is quite relentless in its determination that we shall be cured of those sins at whatever cost to us and at whatever cost to him.
Yeah, there you go.
I keep that on speed dial, by the way. I remind that myself all the time.
Yeah,
I was like, whoa, no, bud, just whipping out the Mere Christianity book right here. Killing it. All right, Tobes, you want to end us with some rapid fires for Stuart, and we'll finish with
absolutely
that.
Yeah, I'm just gonna do a couple ones unique to you and unique to this week, but we're gonna start off. We normally ask, hey, what's your favorite meal of the day? But what I want to ask you is, what's the best meal you've had since coming on the Champions Tour?
Oh, boy. Okay. Which one's the first one? The favorite meal of the day or the favorite meal?
Yeah, go ahead
meal
and answer that one if you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My favorite meal of the day. Favorite meal of the day would be breakfast. I love breakfast. Usually it's like the first time of the day to where you can be excited about eating good food. It's one of my life's loves is enjoying good food. And I'm fortunate to be married to an excellent breakfast maker. So Lisa does great breakfast. So that's probably my favorite meal of the day.
Love it.
Okay. So favorite meal that you've had since traveling on the Champions Tour?
Traveling on the Champions Tour, favorite meal I've had. I'd have to think about that for a sec. Probably, okay, at the Insperity in Houston, there's a tie to the tournament that has that with a steakhouse there, and the name of it, it's just escaping me for now. I wish it wasn't. but they open up the steakhouse to players and families and basically just make a reservation and they just feed you. And it is like first class. It's awesome. So, Bun, you need to make sure that's on the calendar.
Yeah,
for next year. Man, I wish I could remember the name of the steakhouse. It's really a good spot, and the tournament does a solid there. It's really good and super nice. They close it down to anybody that's, just tournament-related players, family. There's a few of the sponsors there, too, but it's just really nice.
Hey, Bun, I remembered I wanted to ask you if I could shadow you for the Houston tournament, so I'll figure out those dates and shadow you for that.
There you go.
Absolutely. Come on. I just canceled two weddings to make that tournament.
Hey, just get Jace to officiate them.
I think you can still do the weddings because I'm pretty sure the steak nights are Wednesday and Thursday.
Perfect.
All right. Next question. How's your barbecue game these days?
My barbecue game is decent, but it hasn't been getting a lot of practice. So it's kind of rusty. And to be honest, it's probably a little bit like outdated right now because whenever we go, me and two guys have a competition team that we compete every now and then. And it's been a little while, 2 years. So every time we go to the competitions, we're kind of still stuck in like 2017 barbecue stuff.
Wait, are they using analytics and barbecue now?
Yes, I think they are. So all the data suggests that we're doing, we're basically playing Bellotta and a wooden driver, and they're all using me and my two buddies who do the barbecue, we love it, but we're all just in this busy time in our life, and we're going to restart sometime, but for now, it's just kind of, we haven't worked it out to where we do any contest cooking.
That's awesome.
Okay, last question, unique to this week. I'm not going to ask you to give us a prediction for the Ryder Cup, but give us your expert opinion, since you've been there playing, you've been an assistant captain. What's going to be fun about this Ryder Cup this year?
Well, I think everybody's been talking about the crowd, the New York crowd, and especially the Bethpage crowd has just been unique to golf. Every time they've played, thinking back, we had the U.S. Open in 2002, I think, and then we had the one that Lucas won in 2009, and then there was a playoff event there. We've been to Bethpage four or five times, and it's the real thing, the crowd, and they know it. They believe in the hype, and they sort of like fulfill it. It's a self-fulfilling deal, and so it's going to be fun to sort of hear the crowd and to see the crowd. I know that the broadcast is going to be focused on some of the crowd action. I'm not totally convinced that it's going to be a pro-American crowd altogether because New York is such an easy place to get to from Europe. I think there's going to be plenty of Europeans in the crowd too, so it's going to be loud for both sides. And but it'll be interesting, and I don't know what they're going to do with the course. Typically the United States team, the home team, that is, has the course set up, so I'm always interested to see what they do. For Bethpage being a major course, it's, you would think, high rough, narrow, premium on driving and all that. But for the Ryder Cup, with us having the right to sort of set the course up until about 3 weeks before the tournament, they'll look at the data and figure out if there's any discrepancies on our team and their team as far as driving distance and accuracy, and kind of like set the course up according to that to be in our favor as much as they can. Like Bun alluded to a little bit about the one in Rome, they pretty much took the wedges out of the hands of both teams because the Americans were clearly a better wedge playing team than the European teams were for that one. And they made the short holes shorter, so everybody just drove the green, took wedges out of your hand, and make the long holes longer. At Bethpage, I don't know that there are any holes that you can really shorten to make them drivable. I can't remember that. So a course setup will be a good, that'll be kind of a geeky golf thing to watch for, but the crowd is probably the number one story to me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I might have to tee off from the start of the fairway on some of them to make it drivable.
They could, and they could do that. They've done that kind of stuff in the past, and just to change it up, and drivable par fours are fun in match play at the highest level. So we'll, I hope we get to see something like that.
Speaking of drivable par fours, the one thing I'm looking forward to, and I'm praying it happens, is what Bryson was doing yesterday on social media, aiming right at the first green off the first tee. If that
over
happens,
the trees.
If that happens on Friday and he hits it within 20 yards of the green, I mean, that's it. I think we've got him. But we need that to happen. The first tee ball. Just boom.
One shot's going to decide it. The first shot that's on it. Friday.
Hey, no, statistically 68%, you have a 68% chance of winning if you win the first match. Over the course of the history, if you win the first match, 68% of the time, that team wins. So,
winning holes does help.
Crazy. I know. And stuff like that, winning the first three holes, or if you win a hole in the first three holes, it like dramatically increases your chance of winning that match.
Yeah.
And our team has, away especially, underperformed on the first two holes, first three holes of our matches. Yeah. And we did it in Italy. And so there's a lot of stuff like that that you can look to. And depending on where the hole is located on the first green, anybody who hits it over the trees and hits it way down in front of the green, as long as you leave yourself a good angle, even coming in from the rough, you know, it's definitely a viable option to take a driver and send it on that hole. Because really, I mean, the consequences aren't that heavy. Just send it.
All right.
Well, Jay, or
to, the whole if you don't feel comfortable sending it, I would suggest tell your partner that they need to hit it.
Yeah, there you go. Well, guys, this has been a lot of fun. Stuart, thanks for coming on, spending some time with us. It's been fun to share some stories and hear more about your life. Jace, Bun, thanks for coming on. It's been fun to get four of us talking about everything golf, life, and faith. So, thanks.
You got it, guys. Good to be with you.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to the Golf Life Faith podcast. Whether you're a college golfer, a coach, or you just love golf, we'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions, please email us at podcast@collegegolffellowship.com. Also, check us out on Instagram at College Golf Fellowship and on Twitter at CGF Tweet. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and be on the lookout for the next episode next month. Cheers.